was out and about trekking yesterday in the wonderful sunlight. I said goodbye to seasonal depression and hello to regular depression. No. It's wonderful, actually. It's kind of the surprise when suddenly, you know, February in the Pacific Northwest, at least in the coastal Pacific Northwest, we were kind of underwater, except of the frozen and fluffy variety.
Oh, it was bad.
It was remarkable how just being out in sort of clear, fresh air during sunlight and blue sky, really, you could feel this difference. And you know what? It had nothing to do with the belief in the supernatural. I did not thank God, because you are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is out today because Sam himself is out trekking through the city in the beautiful blue. You got me today, Becky Friedman. And with me, for the first time together as co-hosts in the studio, we've got Luke.
Hi.
And Tom.
Hey.
So excited to have you guys both on the show today. Tom, it's been a little while, I think, maybe even since 2018, since you've been in front of the mic.
Oh, man. Time flies when you're unconscious. It really does.
There's that. And yeah. Luke, we're happy to have you. Was it up in your peninsula, in the Kitsap area? Was that also nice and blue sky, sunny?
I was just thinking about this last week. I was laying in bed and I felt good. And it was because I saw the sun come up in the morning.
Oh, that's another thing, right? We can actually start work in the sunlight and then end work in the sunlight.
No, I take the ferry over to work, and as when it's clear, you can see the moon, and Jupiter's been up lately, and Venus, and then the sun actually came up over the hills, and it was awesome.
Yeah, it definitely is awesome.
Right. During the winter solstice, it's you leave work and it's basically dark. This too shall pass.
Yep.
And it is.
Yes. So that's a wonderful thing. Even though we still have these piles of snow around Tacoma.
Yeah, my neighbors still have those out in Kitsap too.
It's kind of funny because myself, you know, having grown up in New England, snow sticks around for a long time. And here there's a lot of kids, a lot of colleagues, a lot of friends saying, "Oh my goodness, I never realized snow could be so ugly." Because usually around here, you don't have snow that sticks around for a long period of time, gathering all that, you know, soot and dirt and things like that.
Me and my kids and my brother, we built a snow fort that was big enough to hold two adults comfortably.
I saw photos of that. Yeah. That was amazing.
It was the biggest snow fort I've ever built in my entire life, and it was so fun, and it's still sort of there.
Okay. You got these little sort of ruins.
Little mounds of snow with a piece of plywood on top.
That's like the human activity fast forward on a super fast timeline. You need to go back now and do your sort of paleontological you know, excavations there.
Living here in Puget Sound, Pacific Northwest, for a few years, this first year I was able to make a snowman. Generally it's I put together, you know, mud men. Big balls out of mud, and you know, put a hat on it.
I would think it would be moss. You know, most recently, before moving to Washington, I had spent time in Arizona, and about a year or two after living up here, we had some of our Arizona friends come and visit us, and they were just struck with giggles seeing that there was moss growing between cracks in the freeway. They said, "How is moss growing there? Doesn't anyone use the freeway?" Yeah, all the time. Yeah. It's just really rainy.
There's moss on my Jeep right now. I need to wash it.
So yesterday I was at the South Sound Sustainability Expo, and it was really cool. Some amazing things. I went with a friend of the show, Sharon. She's helped out with some different kinds of things involved in production and studio building and all sorts of stuff over the years. And it was really cool because it brought together things that generally were using the products of human ingenuity through the mechanisms of science to create and sustain, you know, communities. So we had things like how to manage your energy efficiency in your homes, or how to have vermicomposting within your home in a way that doesn't stink up your kitchen, or ways to reduce your consumption of plastic containers. So I actually have jumped on the bottle-less shampoo wagon. I now have a bar soap for shampoo, specifically formulated to be a little bit better pH for hair rather than just, you know, a a bar of Dove or something like
right.
that.
Yeah. In a pinch, cool. I've used Dove because it's a bit better than most soaps, but they actually have solid soap shampoo now.
Yeah, so this is an artisan,
that is cool.
an artisan maker that was there, and it's has tea tree oil and lavender and peppermint, and it, I don't know. I mean, you guys didn't seem to say anything mean about my hair today when we walked in, but it looks pretty normal.
It's about
I think
normal.
Yeah,
yeah,
did
absolutely.
A pretty good job on it. There was one little suggestion of something not scientifically based, and that was about perhaps using things like essential oils to maybe treat your ADHD naturally. And it brought to mind something. Now, Tom, you're a psychiatrist.
Yes.
And you, I assume, are involved in the prescription of medications for things like, I don't know, ADHD.
I have done, yes.
So when someone says, hey, doc, I'd really rather treat my diagnosis, treat whatever is ailing me at a chemical level in my mind, in my brain, whether it was in, you know, spurred by experiences or my genetics or whatever, I'd like to treat it naturally. What's sort of your response to that?
Sometimes people come in after actually doing some pretty good research. There are some natural remedies that there is scientific evidence for, and there are natural remedies that there's no scientific evidence for. And it kind of depends on what they bring to me. I have yet to have somebody come in and say, I want to do this with essential oils, you know, treat my attention problems. What I would probably tell them is there's no evidence that that works.
And on the other hand, some of the things that you do recommend, there would be evidence supporting those particular treatments or interventions.
Yeah, you know, they're under certain circumstances. There's little research, things like fish oil might help your mood a little or reduce your irritability under certain circumstances, not always. Sometimes it can even make it worse. S-adenosylmethionine, it's called SAMe, occasionally can help your mood a little. There's at least some research that suggests that. There are a few things like that. But sometimes people will come in and ask me, well, what can I do that's natural? I've had 5 different medicines and they've all caused this side effect or they didn't work. Is there something else? I'd like to try something natural. And then they'll ask me, and I will try and come up with something and what I'll usually say is, yeah, there's little evidence for this. Occasionally there's more than a little, but it's usually a little, and it's not conclusive, but it's better than nothing. And I'll tell them, all right, this probably won't hurt. I ain't going to promise it helps, but if you're asking, yeah, beat some of the other alternatives you might run into out there.
Okay. So, just in general, vaporizing volatile chemical compounds called essential oils, not really a lot of evidence in terms of treating specific mental ailments and things like that.
Right. There was one research team, I remember back from the 90s, that talked about the aromas and having certain effects, but it seemed pretty arbitrary and I never saw it reproduced, and it kind of... Here's people went around and did lectures on it, and then it just never showed up again anywhere. If it was an effect that was measurable, it wasn't a clinical effect that was useful.
And we know that smells and aromas can bring us back to very, very specific memories that are very early, whether they're positive or negative. I would imagine that if you experience something really, really wonderful, and cinnamon was a smell that was there.
Yeah.
Whether
grandma's cookies.
Yeah, grandma's cookies, or maybe the chewing gum of your favorite babysitter that made you feel safe, something like that, then cinnamon could be really great and could sort of put you at ease. On the other hand, if it was the cinnamon chewing gum of someone who maybe mistreated you as a child and is a vulnerable person. Yeah.
Or a war veteran who smells burning, you know, meat on the grill. That's not good.
So then those kinds of aromas could be really person specific.
Yes.
So any kinds of claims about essential oils being able to naturally treat particular mental distresses and mental ailments, probably not the best scientific and evidence-based treatment.
Right. I know a guy that uses some essential oils that are supposed to be noxious and designed to piss people off.
Oh.
Well, that might work. There's some smells I would, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I thought we had, you know, in my 15 years of being a teacher, I have actually never managed to be in the same place that a kid sets off, quote unquote, a stink bomb. I mean, I've had plenty of smelly kids in my midst, right? but none of these, you know, 1960s or 70s or 80s movies where a stink bomb goes off and everyone says, ah, and runs and scatters.
I saw a couple people when I was in school bringing those in, little glass vials full of stinky oil. Smelt one or two, but usually not so much.
I don't know, just overcook the cabbage in the nutrition and wellness room in the home ec room.
just leave some
we're
broccoli.
Making sauerkraut.
Just leave some broccoli in a locker somewhere. That'll probably do it.
Yeah, probably. So another neat thing that is happening in the Pacific Northwest, a little bit to our south, we talked about it a few weeks ago, is that the Portland City Council has actually gone through and approved their protections against discrimination explicitly for non-religious people and atheists. And now, Luke and Tom, neither of you were on Ask an Atheist on the day that we talked about this when, you know, Portland City Council was gearing up to say, should we have a vote on it? And I wanted to know your opinions on this. You know, when we have ordinances at the municipal level that are perhaps stronger than federal protections against discrimination, should we have things that explicitly protect atheists and non-religious individuals?
Well, I appreciate it. I think we talked about this a little bit. We're technically protected by creed, right?
I thought so too.
Well, except where some politicians insist that we are not protected.
So
because of that, and they want to specifically discriminate, and you'd think, well, you know, why do you feel the need to specifically discriminate against us? But apparently they do. And because they exist, yeah, I think it's a good idea that we be listed.
Oh, we're not part of their club.
Uh-huh.
And no, we can't have that.
Now, are you kind of talking about folks that say, well, if you're an atheist, you don't actually have a creed because creed is believing in something and atheists don't believe in anything? How often have you guys heard that refrain?
I've seen that one a couple of times.
Yeah, but I really don't think anything in the Constitution, you know, makes that fine distinction.
I don't think so either. And I would say just because you're an atheist and you don't believe in God or gods doesn't mean that you don't believe in anything. I think that there's a lot of funny things that people believe, whether you're an atheist or not. And there's a lot of things that people believe in, even when they're an atheist, that might be very common to humanity in general, like believe that it is good to help your fellow human. People that are atheists can also believe in love or believe in community or believe in the power of singing to help you feel good, you know, or something like that. And I think that when it just really irks me when you say, well, you're an atheist, you don't believe in anything. No, yeah. I believe in the value personally of public education, of free and compulsory public education without discrimination for, you know, individuals. That's a belief of mine that I hold.
There are certainly atheistic religions, you know, ones that don't actually believe in a God. You have Sam Harris and his atheist spirituality.
Is that classified as a religion, though?
Sam Harris? I hope not.
I think that it rides that really interesting line where in our American history, we've had to count things like atheism or secular humanism as classified as a religion in order to be free from discrimination or in order to be entitled to the same rights as the individuals that come from the panoply of religious observances and communities that we have in our pluralistic society. So you have in certain systems, like within a federal prison system, secular humanism being counted as a religion so that individuals that are incarcerated may also gather with like-minded individuals to have study sessions instead of, you know, being assigned some, you know, crappy, crummy duty or not have the privilege of gathering and having that companionship and camaraderie.
Then you have people using that against us in times like the library reading hour, where they were banning it from being publicly held because it was the religion of secular humanism.
Oh, my goodness. If anyone says, I think you're referring to a few places where there was drag queen story time, right? Okay, and yeah, someone said we can't have drag queen story time because it promotes the religion of secular humanism. Yep. There's a lot of secular humanists that aren't drag queens.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how they equate. Okay.
Keep trying, because I am.
Yeah, I haven't figured that one out.
But I think overall, I'm with you guys that having that particular protection explicitly saying that atheists are protected from discrimination is a good thing. It says that, you know what, just because you were an atheist doesn't mean that you have fewer rights to be protected from discrimination in public accommodation and rental housing or anything. As a Muslim, a Christian, a Buddhist, this is Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Our voicemail number is 844-SKEPTIC. You can give us a voicemail at any particular time. It's me, Becky, and I'm still in the studio here with Luke and Tom. And I want to go to Missouri to talk about something that's really getting under my skin. You guys ready? Come with me?
Sure.
Because a Missouri lawmaker wants to change state regulations such that any plaintiff filing a church-state separation lawsuit would have to reveal their full name instead of initials or the conventional John or Jane Doe. Currently, in most cases, judges can allow plaintiffs to proceed using a pseudonym if a judge finds that potential danger exists for the plaintiffs. Republican State Representative Hardy Billington's HB 728 would strip judges of the power to protect plaintiffs, even if a judge knew that someone could be in imminent physical danger. Individuals from American Atheists, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and Americans United for the Separation of Church and State have all testified that plaintiffs in these sorts of cases have been targets of harassment, credible death threats, and being ostracized. Representative Billington's goal in the legislature is to stand up for Christian values.
Which are harassment?
Bullying?
Ostracization. Yeah. Death threats. Let's throw it all in for good measure. You guys bring a good point. You know, when you say, I want to stand up for Christian values, it's not, you know, small C Christian when someone says, how very Christian of you to do that. Meaning how empathetic or how charitable or how lovely of you to do something. Now, when we see a legislator saying, I want to stand up for Christian values, unmasking atheists who could be the target of death threats, that seems to be a very different definition of Christian values. And I think you guys are right on the money there when you say we're talking about, you know, bullying and harassment.
These are Inquisition values.
Yeah. This is somebody trying to attack people that are not, again, part of his club because they don't live the way he wants them to.
Well, and any time that you have lawsuits that are brought most of the time by atheists, but also by folks that are not part of the dominant religious, sort of rhetoric and substrate. You know, we saw in Louisiana, you had a little boy who came from a Buddhist family who was being ostracized in his school district, given all of the religious, the Christian religious, rhetoric and endorsements at many levels of his school. He was not an atheist. He wasn't an atheist family, but it's a lawsuit about separation of church and state. It was a child that received such harassment that he had to go to a different school district in a different parish 45 minutes away. Have you guys heard about...
I didn't heard that.
Individuals where in light of bringing a lawsuit that stands up for the separation of church and state, stands up for constitutional values, receive death threats, receive ugly, harassing, violent threats.
This I have heard. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's happening in schools, right, you're dealing with children. You're dealing with plaintiffs, the folks that have standing when you're looking at school, government employees endorsing religious values. The plaintiffs are children. Most of the time, children are protected in lawsuits. Most of the time, they're known by a first name only or by initials. Or the parent's last name is obscured to protect a child's identity.
I suppose, though, in real life, it's pretty easy to figure out who the child might be.
I imagine it might be, especially in the case of someone who's the facts of the case would expound upon the background of the plaintiff, either being a non-believer or a Buddhist or, you know, some member of a minority religion. If there's someone of a minority religion, it might be easy to figure them out based on an ethnicity that's often associated with that religion. But just having a lawsuit obscure your name is one step that can happen that can help protect individuals who bring these kinds of lawsuits. Again, lawsuits that are there to stand up for constitutional values, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being able to say, just in these cases, we want to erase this ability for judges to anonymize plaintiffs. Just in these cases, it really worries me. You know, do you guys see that this is a thing that could go forward? I mean, what would be sort of the implications of this?
Well, I suppose it's going to depend on what the political situation in Missouri is right now.
It's Republican dominated at every level.
I suspect it could go to a federal level pretty quick. I mean, it's going to be appealed up.
What worries me here is if it's appealed, you know, the individual is saying, I just want to not have judges be able to anonymize people in church-state separation cases.
And only those cases.
And he can argue, well, it's not that I'm attacking someone based on their religion or lack of thereof, because anyone is able to bring a church-state separation lawsuit. But let's look at it. Who actually brings lawsuits of church-state separation? You know, right now in the Supreme Court of the United States, they just finished hearing arguments about the Bladensburg Cross down in Maryland.
Right.
And it was one of the few times that we've actually had a religious organization arguing that government endorsement of religion happens when you have a big cross on government property. We had a Baptist group that actually argues for separation of church and state. It's one of the few times that you have religious individuals arguing for separation of church and state. Let's face it, who are the people that are usually kind of bringing these lawsuits?
Us.
Us? Mm-hmm. Atheists? Humanists?
Yep.
People of non-Christian faiths. And so It's very clear to me that this is just a proxy for targeting minority religious individuals and atheists.
And I mean, the way they're doing it, you know, it's sort of a fig leaf of, oh, this isn't discrimination, but it is certainly nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah, that's
and it's targeted. Exactly what it is. It's way too targeted.
What was his justification again? I don't know.
To stand up for Christian values. Didn't you hear him? Yeah. Didn't you see his Facebook?
Everyone knows what that means, right?
Well, okay, great.
What does
that mean?
Apparently it means leave atheist children open to harassment and death threats.
You know, injustice seems to be eternal, and institutionalized injustice, it's just a struggle I think we're always going to have to have.
I was in Missouri.
This is where the line is.
Like 2 years ago, I was in Kansas City, and it was a beautiful place. It was like the middle of July. The grass was all green, which was really weird for me because in the middle of the summer, the grass is not supposed to be green.
Okay, grass goes brown dormant. Brown, yep.
It's a great place, great town, awesome restaurants, great beer, good people. And every time I hear this, I can't really make the Missouri that I've seen, the Missouri that is politics, mesh together for some reason. They're just so odd.
I think what it might speak to is something that it's not, you know, our country is experiencing not so much different areas of left coast, right coast, you know, left coast or east coast, and then the middle of the country. We don't have these strict borders, but we have urban concentrations, yep, which tend to be more liberal, and then more rural concentrations, which tend to be not as liberal or more strident in their so-called Christian values. mm-hmm. And we see that in Washington. You know, everyone thinks, yes, Washington State is so blue. Well, you look a little closer. No, there's actually kind of a dividing line right along the Cascades, and everything to the west of the Cascades dividing line is all blue, and everything to the right of that is all red. And then you look a little bit closer beyond that, and that's not even accurate. When you look at Pierce County, the county where this show is recorded, and you had a citizens' initiative, a vote on whether LGBT folks should be granted the ability to get married. This is before Obergefell v. Hodges at the federal level, you know, legalized marriage equality nationwide. You had Pierce County that didn't even vote for it as a majority. You know, and you say that, look, Pierce County, you know, we got Tacoma. Tacoma was voted by the Advocate as one of the gayest cities or gay friendliest cities, you know, a couple times. It was on their top 10 list, things like that.
I think it's number one at least once.
Yeah. And at the same time, the county that it's in the middle of couldn't even agree that gay folks should have the privilege to be married, just as you know, people of opposite genders or differing genders had the privilege for so long. They didn't agree that it should be a right. They said it was a privilege for just, you know, heterosexual folks or folks in heterosexual relationships. And so, you know, what you're talking about in terms of Kansas City versus the rest of Missouri and reconciling, how is Missouri dominated at all levels of government by conservative religious Republicans when, in your experience, you know, it was just so awesome and people were cool and whatnot? I mean, I don't know. Did you present as someone of a minority religious status? Did you present as someone who has been target of these particular, you know, feelings of Missourians?
Or you might have gotten a different reception.
And that's what I think, you know, as we as atheists, you know, sometimes have the privilege to hide what our particular minority status might be. And then you have places like Portland, where a third of the individuals profess to have no particular religion, where it's not even really a minority status. And that's the place that says, you know what, we're not going to target atheists. We're going to explicitly say that you're included amongst all of the other individuals.
Yeah, at work, I don't talk about it because, well, it gets complicated.
I imagine. So let's see. Let's bring ourselves to some feedback from listeners. Tasif from Maharashtra, India, asks, what would it take logically to get an atheist to believe in a god?
I'd go with actual physical evidence.
Evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. That Bill Nye's reply to more or less that same question. Evidence.
Okay. To me, my question here is, the definition of a god, right? Most gods in most particular traditions have some element of supernatural. Am I off base here, guys?
No, definitely accurate.
Okay. So as an atheist, I really like looking at evidence through an empirical scientific method, things like that. Once you start asking the questions that can be testable questions, you're not asking them about something supernatural. And once you start providing evidence, is this god actually supernatural anymore? Wouldn't it just be natural? And at that point, is it even a god anymore?
So
there's this being standing over there looking at us.
We're just talking about super powerful aliens at that point?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if we were to go back in time 2,000 years, would we be considered gods? The things that we are able to do, the all the world's information available in our back pocket through a little telephone device, the fact that these radio waves are hitting your ears right now, the fact that we can speak in one area of the country where it is daytime and someone else right now in a place of the world where it is nighttime can hear our voices, that seems kind of godly based on 2,000 years ago.
And I'm quite sure there are some among us, not in this room, but some among us who would love
for yourself,
to be
Tom.
Well, that would love to be perceived that way.
Hey, I spent 15 years trying to teach K-12 education. Sometimes it would come in handy.
I am your god.
I'll settle for benevolent dictator.
I just try to make antibiotics first thing.
Yeah.
If you were there saying, yeah, all right, if we went back in 2,000 years, here.
Okay, first thing, antibiotics.
Antibiotics. Look, no more urinary tract infections or conjunctivitis.
Yay.
I don't know. I think I would make eyeglasses, right?
That's cool.
Because I would have not been successful past about age 11, circa 2,000 years ago.
For me, I would have died of like chronic ear and sinus infections. So I'm looking at myself.
Yeah,
we each
got our own priorities. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, what would it take for an atheist to believe in a god? I think that there's people that are atheists because they grew up in a religious context and then found that the belief systems didn't really fit their standard of evidence. There's other folks that are just atheists because they didn't grow up with any particular religion in the first place. And they happened most of the time to be educated in science. So I think using a scientific framework to get someone to believe logically in the existence of a god, it sort of contravenes what humans have developed gods and religion to serve and to be.
Science became science, you know, the Enlightenment period, when they systematically took God out of all the equations of, say, alchemy and even philosophy, moral philosophy. They took God out of it and saw that, oh, it still works. works better.
I like that as well. I'm going to push back on a little bit that science became science in the Enlightenment, because I like to, you know, I will teach science credit recovery courses for kids that are maybe 16, 17, 18 years old that have a history of not really experiencing academic success with science. And so they think that science is something that is done in white lab coats, in, you know, completely internal rooms by highly educated people that they will never be. And I say, you know what? Science is so darn simple that even a baby can do it. I believe every baby is a scientist. You guys with me so far?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the thing. You have some observations about the world. And this I credit to a comic that I saw online. And
now, where are you going with this?
I can't remember or recall the person who generated this particular comic, but I love it in terms of an image because it's like a six-step process, and babies do it all the time.
Yes.
You make some observations about the world around you, and from there you ask a question. And so a baby's crawling along and they find some mass of something on the floor and they're like, huh, I wonder what this is. Then they form a hypothesis. If I put it in my mouth, it will taste good because things that I put in my mouth generally taste good because babies put everything in their mouth and they try out whether something's food and tasty. So then they go and conduct their experiment and they put that mass of stuff that they found on the floor in the kitchen into their mouth. And then they gotta gather some results. They gotta gather some data, right? Ew, this is gross. So then they conclude this is not food, nor is it tasty. My hypothesis has been disproven. Right? And that's their conclusion. There's one amazing step that a lot of people forget when they're looking at the scientific method, and that is sharing out your results. You know, you can be a scientist engaging in science alone only to a certain degree. You got to be able to share your results and have it replicated by others. And babies are most excellent at this step. Because what does a baby do when they put something in their mouth that's icky and they don't like? They share their results, either by...
crying?
Oh, yeah, crying, yep. Screaming, spitting up.
Oh, that was when Jackson was crawling around the floor, he got a hold of a habanero seed.
Uh-oh.
And did he perform science?
He performed science with that habanero seed, and it was unfortunate and awful and lots of screaming and rinsing with milk and trying to get that capsaicin out of his mouth.
I imagine he shared his results quite vocally.
Quite vocally. There was much screaming.
So after peer review, was it concluded that habanero seeds are a bad choice for putting in your mouth at age 18 months?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I really like the invitation to get others to replicate your experiment, because even though you can have a baby that really hates this particular thing, what are they going to do? They're going to hand it off to you.
Oh, yeah.
You try it. You put it in your mouth and see. I want you to experience the same kind of pain. So Enlightenment, babies, I think all of us can science. But in terms of asking those testable questions, when you say, what would get us to believe in a God? I mean... You grew up in a semi-religious context?
I did grow up Lutheran, yes.
And there's a part of Lutheranism that is based on good works and based on community, hanging out and having potlucks and things like that, but also there's an element of faith, if
right.
I'm not mistaken. If you have faith, or when you were asked to have faith, were you asked to do that in the face of contradictory evidence?
Oh, absolutely. Plus, they tried to make up stories that would make it so the evidence wouldn't contradict, but their stories didn't make sense. Like the time they told me that the reason dinosaur bones are all found in the same place is because before the flood, they were in dinosaur parks.
Oh, in dinosaur parks?
Yes, like zoos.
Zoos. Oh!
No kidding. And where there were humans.
Yes, because there were humans there.
This is just moving the contradiction over.
Yeah, that's all it was. And I was a huge dinosaur fan at the time, and I was like, no.
Nope.
No, that's wrong.
So, Tom, were you raised in any sort of religious context?
Oh, Episcopal.
Okay.
And very staid.
Were you asked to have faith? I mean, it's Episcopalians are somewhat similar to Anglican or Catholics, and there's a credo somewhere in there.
I think it was implied throughout that, there will be faith here. There were some... I had a girlfriend that actually, she was Lutheran, and I'd go with her to a Lutheran church, and it was on campus, and there, you know, the minister was smart enough and also knew that these were college kids and probably, you know, a little above, and he was like, no, it doesn't have to make sense, but you still have faith, and he said it out loud.
That's what I wish that all religious individuals who profess faith would just do and say, when you have faith, it's not, you're not supposed to be looking for evidence. Faith is something that happens just because, and just because you're moved, it's working on an emotional level. And for an atheist, reconciling faith with evidence is just as silly to me as a religious person trying to reconcile faith with evidence. Because if you have evidence for it, now you're knowing it, and it's no longer faith. Yep.
Faith
is no
longer necessary.
Disproving your own faith?
Hmm? You know, I think there are a lot of things that are not rational that do move you emotionally.
Wait, are you a true atheist? Are you saying that atheists can have true emotions?
That was the first half of
wonder.
The first half of a longer sentence.
Sometimes I'm hungry. That counts, right?
But I don't think you have to actually believe it to be moved by it.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more.
There's a lot of stuff out there where you can. On a funny sense, I like the church's subgenius that defines everything they do as, you know, utter baloney, and thereby come to some actual truths, you know. I'd have to think about specific examples, but I think even you look at a novel, nothing in there, you know, at least in some novels, happened at all, and yet it reveals a truth, but it's not the thing itself.
Any work of fiction would fit there.
And it move you dearly and do show you great truths. And I think that some religions can show you truths and be very moving, but it doesn't mean that, you know, God exists.
I think, you know, you're reminding me of some studies that have shown that when individuals read more fiction, they grow their sort of empathy noggin, right? There have been studies that show that kids that have read the Harry Potter series have a better understanding of social justice and fairness with regards to differences, whether it's race or disability or means, you know, what social class you come from. Because they're able to identify with the characters. I don't think any of those kids that have read the Harry Potter series think that Voldemort's real. You know, I don't think that anyone thinks that that Hagrid really lives in a little cabin and trains, you know, dragons and things like that.
But nobody, if you know what, if you're raised to believe those things, you might.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, this actually, with all of this talk of, you know, emotions and beauty and empathy, it actually reminds me a little bit of an Onion article headline I saw this week. Luke, do you read the Onion sometimes?
I follow them on Twitter and see them on the Facebook all the time.
So we were called out a little bit this week. It said, so-called atheist doesn't even barge into churches screaming, "You're all brainwashed fools."
Oh, man. They need to do harder job. Wait,
I do.
Better job.
Do you really, Tom?
No.
Let's put an APB on Tom and prevent him from going into your church. No, what I think this speaks to also is that when you say atheist to folks that maybe haven't really been outside of their particular religious circle or religious realm, who do they think of? They think of someone that's going to scream to you saying you're all fools and stupid and you don't believe in anything, right?
I'm sure there's an atheist out there somewhere who does that. I don't know any.
Oh, I'm sure. There's tons of them screaming on the internet. Sometimes I'm one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It happens. No,
But to go into the church and do that,
that's just rude.
I'm sure somebody does, and you know that's the example. You know, there's an atheist for you.
Yeah, no, I just had to do that myself, a week and a half ago?
Be the atheist in a church?
Be the atheist in a church. Unfortunately, my youngest son got to experience another funeral, and we went to a Catholic church this time.
Okay.
It was a different experience, more solemn. Obviously, we were back in the back screaming about how everybody was wrong. We didn't do that at all. It's mostly an experience of, Jackson, don't kick the pews. The books are not to play with. Don't draw there. But it was, compared to the Protestant funeral, I liked it better.
Okay.
It was nicer. They didn't talk about how everybody should start going to church, because I'm sure that had something to do with the last one. You know, my particular lack of faith, and my grandmother and my grandfather being super religious. My grandfather was a pastor. At least part-time. And so that one was all about how everybody should follow my grandparents in faith. And this one was about how this amazing teacher that was at my son's school contributed so much to society and helped everybody out. And it was really actually quite beautiful.
I think that is uplifting. And you will get that with sometimes Protestant funerals or non-religious funerals and, you know, and Catholic funerals. The other hand, I had my last remaining grandparent die, and I did not attend the funeral, but I was really, you know, honored to receive a copy of the eulogy that was written. And the eulogy was given at a memorial service right after she had passed, and then was given at the funeral when the family could get together. Most of the other extended family members could get together, you know, a couple months later. And for the one that was given in the Catholic Church, the pastor had to edit out some other things because it was not really Catholic enough or challenged some of the Catholic beliefs, even though my grandmother was a steadfast, pious Catholic. I mean, she named two of her children Mary. The first one died, so she still had to have a child named Mary, you know? I mean, and for a pastor who didn't know an individual to then bastardize an event to say, come to religion, as was your case with the Protestant funeral, or in the case of my grandmother, with let's not talk about all of the parts that might challenge a little bit of the Catholic status quo, I think is really disappointing for not just atheists, but for someone that wants to respect the life and legacy of a particular individual. So I'm really happy that it seems like in this case, this woman who, you know, who died did have her life and legacy treasured.
Yeah. She was a really great contributor to my son's early life, and I really appreciated her.
Well, you know, is it possible to have a Catholic or whatever branch of Protestant service funeral? Is it still a Catholic ceremony or Protestant ceremony if they take the propaganda out of it and make it about the person?
Well, you're still going to have the incense. Yeah. You're still going to have the arias in Latin.
Is that propaganda?
Was all still there. Yeah. That's religious. I mean, it was a classic Catholic mass. I've been to a couple because of past relationships, and it was that plus funeral.
Yeah. I guess when I was saying propaganda is the throw in there, you've got to believe this. In every, no matter what else is going on, you have to say, you must believe this
as part of it. They didn't really do that. Appreciate that. It was much nicer than the Protestant one.
Well, if you've got a question or an experience about a funeral as an atheist or as a religious individual, tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA and let us know what your experience was. Hopefully you've never been that atheist that barges into a church saying, you're all fools. We don't like that. We'll be back after the break with a few more comments and stories that kind of irk us or make us ponder. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. We've got, I don't know, all sorts of things we're covering today. We've got things from the aspect of skepticism, from medical aspects of things, from the secular humanistic perspective. One thing that's really hard sometimes is when we hear religious freedom, because sometimes that can be, as we mentioned earlier in the show, a code word for harassment, bigotry, death threats, all those kinds of things. But somehow the way that religious freedom gets instituted in different countries might seem a little bit different from how it's perceived in our United States. The Netherlands has adjudicated two religious freedom cases, both involving Muslim men having their state assistance benefits reduced. The first man refused a job opportunity doing asbestos abatement because it would have required him to shave his beard, contrary to his religious observance. The court ruled that the infringement on his religious rights was acceptable because the man was unlikely to find a guaranteed job elsewhere on account of his history. The second man had his benefits reduced after he turned down a job as a store clerk that would have required him to work on Friday afternoons when Muslims generally attend mosque and pray. The court found that his state benefits were wrongfully reduced because the store manager could have accommodated his religion by scheduling the man to work shifts that did not include Friday afternoons. So, Tom and Luke, we've got two kind of opposing cases. Both involve individuals who are receiving welfare and, you know, which in, I guess, I gather in the Netherlands requires you to either be job seeking or accept a job as soon as it's kind of offered to you. And if you turn it down, hey, you're not complying with the expectations of helping our you know, community and society. So we're gonna cut some of that off for you. Unlike the guy's beard, right?
Right. Mm. No, that one bothers me. That man, I believe that man lost his benefits inappropriately.
Okay, so you're not in agreement with the court.
I'm not. In my opinion, it is his religious right to maintain his appearance in accordance with his religion, which means obviously he can't be wearing a respirator because he has to have a beard, so he can't do that job.
Okay. Even if that's really one of the only jobs that he's ever likely to get because of whatever was in his history or background that would prevent him from working elsewhere?
If you're doing some sort of I believe this was asbestos abatement,
mm-hmm.
You can do other jobs that are similar that don't require you or a respirator.
Okay.
There are many other jobs.
We in the States call reasonable accommodations?
Absolutely.
So you think it would have been reasonable to accommodate finding him a job somewhere that didn't require him to be clean-shaven?
Absolutely. Now, they said that there were some past history that may lead the court to think that there were issues here, but I don't think that should apply in this case, because this was clearly him trying to exercise his religion in a way that he sees fit. I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Now, the other guy, I like that he won.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, one thing I'm noticing here is that at least the courts in the Netherlands aren't systematically, this does not appear to be a case where they systematically start ruling against people because they're Muslims or because of their religion. You know, you see two different outcomes based on, you may not agree with the merits one way or another, but what seem to be merits of the situation as opposed to some, you know, you're Muslim, therefore you got to do it our way.
Yeah. And,
I think
matter.
That's important to draw attention to, especially as Europe deals with, sort of increased awareness and tensions between the white European communities and then Muslim immigrant communities or Muslim second or third generation communities, especially as different countries in Europe have taken on many refugees from majority Muslim nations. And, you know, when you're an immigrant and a refugee, you know, you pack everything in your you know, one or two suitcases sometimes, and you don't have very much. And so a lot of those individuals, I would imagine, would require state assistance. Just like in the United States, where we have this, oft-mentioned cry that, the immigrants from south of our border are stealing our jobs and taking away our benefits and being a drain on the state, you're having some of that, too, in Europe.
Yeah.
Now, when you delve deeper into it, you see, oh, look, in the United States, undocumented individuals cannot receive welfare benefits in many, you know, in most circumstances. Refugees can, because they are specifically placed in the United States through refugee resettlement.
They're protected by law.
Mm. Right. In a time when, yeah, there are increased tensions by the native European populations against Muslim individuals, I think you're right, Tom, that this shows that there's two kind of similar cases, but there's not a universal declaration against the religious freedoms of Muslim
right.
individuals because they're Muslim, whereas everyone else gets to exert their religious freedom.
I think in the second case, the fault lies with the employer who refused to change the schedule around, even though it was a possibility.
I think that a lot of Americans who are underemployed can relate to that.
Yeah, I remember those jobs.
When you have schedules that you don't know which shifts you're going to be working, how many hours you're going to get per week, things like that, I really hope that that's not bleeding over into Europe or well-entrenched and established there. And any kind of ruling that sort of says to an employer, hey, you can reasonably accommodate this person, so do it. I think that that's something good, because it paves the way for other people to be reasonably accommodated based on, family, based on religion, based on lots of other kinds of things. So I think that's pretty cool. I'm going to take us back over to this continent, guys, but up to Canada. Okay, I know we're pretty close, but we're going to go to the other side, over to Nova Scotia, where a Canadian chiropractor who professed unfounded claims regarding vaccines and other medical procedures online has agreed to relinquish her license due to professional incompetence arising out of mental incapacity. Dina Churchill, who worked in Halifax, admitted to the charge and surrendered her license back in January. If Churchill wants to reapply to work in chiropractic in the province of Nova Scotia, she must present a qualified medical opinion on her mental state. Governing bodies in Canada explicitly stipulate that chiropractors must not comment on vaccines in any capacity.
I notice they don't say what the nature of this mental incapacity is. That's a pretty big thing.
Well, this is a thing that she agreed to, and that, you know, incompetence based on mental incapacity is a particular category that could get your license revoked.
Talking about vaccines, anti-vax, whatevs, that may just be a tip of the iceberg that they had, they could get the handle on. She may have had a lot more going on than
I mean,
you know?
Was she declared mentally incompetent just because she was preaching anti-vax stuff, or is there something more to it?
That's not, a lot of people preach anti-vax who aren't have mental incapacity. That's pretty major stuff.
I think what you're hitting on there, Tom, is, you know, this woman was a chiropractor. She offered services in an area of medicine that is not really accepted by medical science and evidence. You know, sometimes if you get into a car accident and, you know, I need someone to press on my back and give me a massage to make things feel better, like, I get that. But once you get into sort of the foundations of chiropractic, where you say, if I wiggle your ears fast enough and in certain, you know, directions, counterclockwise versus clockwise, then suddenly all of your asthma will be cured. That's where I say, hey, is chiropractic real or not?
There's core chiropractic, which is, you know, the back manipulation. And there's some empirical evidence. The original theory behind it, some sort of subluxation, doesn't seem anatomically real, but
so subluxation meaning like a bone popping
the bones,
out from
the bones out of place. Now somebody might write in and say, oh, he got it wrong. I don't mean to be, I'm going to use kind of general terms here without necessarily getting him just accurate for these purposes, but yeah, they call it subluxation.
We don't want you declared mentally incapacitated.
thank you I think the governing body of the, at least the American chiropractor, said, okay, we admit that the subluxation as we described it before, it isn't accurate, but it still stands. The research shows this works. And we talk about subluxation, it's not the same thing that the orthopedic physicians are talking about, you know, the MDs, DOs, it's a different thing. However, you get away from the core chiropractic and start getting into these, I think they call it applied kinesiology, which is different than the kinesiology exercise, you know, physiologists do.
Okay.
It starts looking like baloney.
So there we get the wiggle your ears counterclockwise and your asthma will be cured.
I will put this substance, you know, maybe you have an allergy to this. I'll put it on the back of your neck and check your arm strength as you stick your arm out. And if you suddenly get weak because I touch this to your skin, that just sounds like Ouija board to me. You can kind of move things without even realizing it, make things happen in a certain way.
Or incredibly unsafe if they have a severe allergy.
Well, there's that. Yeah.
So one thing here that sort of worries me, I like that, okay, this lady that was saying she, you know, she has no business talking about vaccines and steering people away from vaccines. She's practicing something that's kind of full of bunk. Right now, though, She's been essentially de-doctorized, right? She has no medical license. Yep. She has no chiropractic license, excuse me. And now there's no professional ethics telling her not to be an anti-vaxxer propagandist.
Now she can do whatever she wants.
Well, like anyone else who's an anti-vaxxer propagandist, right, who doesn't have a license to worry about, she no longer does. And I do suspect that things would go differently in the United States, or if she was so incapacitated that she really couldn't practice, it would go through a different route to get there. But I don't know. There's not enough information here really to go by.
Yeah. Well. Meanwhile, we do see that in the midst of a lot more seeming activity by anti-vaxxer propagandists, we actually see that a lot of media companies are kind of trying to mitigate this. You've got, you know, Facebook sort of downranking things that have been fact checked. You have Pinterest saying you can't even search for the terms vaccine or vaccination.
I definitely appreciate that.
Did you know that 80% of American moms have a Pinterest account? women who are mothers in America, 80% of them apparently have a Pinterest account.
Why doesn't this shock me? I haven't heard that.
It's actually really useful for a lot of things.
So, and it said actually 38% of dads, so fathers, can't just say that this is a mom thing, right? But people who are caretakers, there's a good chunk of America who are on Pinterest.
It's fantastic for Dungeons & Dragons maps.
All right, there we
go.
No
kidding.
Yeah, tons of
something that had not occurred to me. You have Amazon that's removing some of the anti-vax propaganda films from its streaming services. And what's the other one? Oh, and you have YouTube that's actually demonetized any of these folks with a ton of followers that can get money from, you know, ads playing on their little video clips. They've demonetized anything that's, or are working to do it.
Taking money away from people that are taking advantage of people always makes me happy.
I mean, shrill things always sell, and it doesn't. Here's another thing that it doesn't have to be true to move you.
So, shrill things always sell. So, you're all fools. Oh, look at us. We are non-commercial. We are Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You can tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA. You can find us on Facebook, where we welcome you fact-checking us. You can write us with emails at questions@atheist.radio and find all of our episodes at atheist.radio. Give us voicemails whenever you want at 844-SKEPTIC. We love you guys, and we'll see you next week.